This is a rowdy crowd here tonight. I'd like to welcome everyone to our forum entitled Radical Dissent, the Righteous Response to an Unjust System. Our featured speaker this evening is Lynn Stewart, and I'll say a few things about her in just a moment. Tonight's forum is taking place as part of Radical Women's 41st Anniversary National Conference, The Persistent Power of Socialist Feminism. The conference began this morning and will extend through Monday. Radical Women is a socialist feminist organization that was founded in 1967. It's dedicated to exposing, resisting, and eliminating the inequalities of women's existence. We see the source and cause of our oppression as women, the oppression of people of color, lesbians, gays, bisexual, transgender people, elders, youth, the disabled, immigrants, workers everywhere. All of these are caused by the capitalist system itself. To free ourselves and everyone else, we need to defeat the racism, sexism, homophobia, ageism, and every other form of mental pollution that the capitalists have been feeding us to keep us divided from each other. When we join together, we can stop working for them and start running the world for ourselves and for everybody, every human being, every animal on the planet itself. It is then that we will all know true equality and true democracy. I invite anyone here who hasn't registered for the conference to come back tomorrow or Sunday or Monday or all 3 days. Our discussions are open. We're eager to hear from our visitors as well as our members as we are planning our course for the future that we hope will lead us sooner rather than later to that full liberation that we all want so much. Tonight, Lynn will speak. We'll have time for questions and discussion from the audience. There are microphones in the middle and on the side. And if people would like to line up at those when the discussion starts, we'd ask people to keep comments fairly short so that everybody who wants to ask a question has an opportunity to do so. And then we'll have some announcements, and we'll have a reception here afterwards where we can talk with Lynn and each other more informally. And we encourage people to stay for that. Lynn is not someone who figured that she would start out the beginning of the 21st century as a poster child for the opposition to the USA Patriot Act. However, people always have a choice in these matters when we decide to be activists all of our lives, and so that's what happened with Lynn. At about the time that Radical Women was being formed in the 1960s. Lynn was embarking on her teaching and librarian career in the New York City public schools, where she began her own dissent, troublemaking career, by standing up for and fighting for quality universal education, for community control of the schools, and those things that we are still fighting for. In the early 1970s, she attended Rutgers Law School, in New Jersey, and for 25 years after that, she practiced law in New York City, primarily doing court-appointed criminal defense work. In the 1980s and 1990s, she defended a number of political activists, including Black Panthers, members of the Black Liberation Army, members of the Weather Underground, the Ohio Seven, Richard Williams, and Larry Davis. But she also defended hundreds, if not thousands, of ordinary people who got enmeshed in a criminal justice system in this country. In 1995, she was appointed to represent Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the Egyptian religious leader charged with conspiring to commit acts of terrorism in the months after the 1993 World Trade Center bombings. He was convicted and given a life sentence. Lynn continued to represent him during his appeals and afterwards in an attempt to improve his conditions of his imprisonment and getting transferred back to Egypt. By then he was 80 years old, blind, sick, and isolated in solitary confinement. For zealously representing him, as criminal defense lawyers are supposed to do, and for speaking out about matters of public concern, and issuing a press release on his behalf, after Ramsey Clark and other people had issued many press releases on his behalf, Lynn was arrested and convicted of conspiracy and providing support for terrorism. She is out on bail while she's appealing her 28-month sentence. The government is appealing, saying that she should have had a 30-year sentence. And Lynn is asking for all of the outrageous charges and the travesty of justice that took place over 6 months in that New York courtroom to be overturned. Throughout all of her representation of clients and defending herself in her own case, Lynn has stood up for the highest constitutional principles and never sought an easy way out for herself. She has also refrained from being silenced, which is what the government, of course, wanted for her and wanted for all of us. But while waiting for the appeal results, she has been speaking all over the country. We hear her on the radio in defense of Lamia Abu-Jamal. We hear her, I hear her on telephone calls organizing anti-war conferences for Cleveland earlier last summer. And she's speaking out all across the country on behalf of everyone who's fighting the fight to change the system and change the world to one that we can truly live in. So with nothing further from me, I introduce Lynn Stewart. Because it's radical dissent, the righteous response to an unjust system, and somehow or other in the days in which we are now finding ourselves, we have to talk a little bit more than just dissent. We have to talk about confrontations, I think. And we have to give ourselves a little higher task than just response. Response is easy. Response is, as the old days would have said, petty bourgeois radicalism. But if we are truly radical, then we have to come up with better than just a response to this unjust system. It is coming to a head. It came to a head in the way that Marx predicted it would come to a head. We are going to see an era ahead of us in which they print money. They print it endlessly. They print treasury bills. They print whatever they can foist upon the American public as being worth something. And you and I have a task, which is to make sure the American people know exactly what is being done to them. And it's not enough to say, oh, this is too complicated for me. Economics, I didn't join this. I want to pick it. I want to organize. You have to understand it. And you have to understand it from the Marxist point of view, it seems to me. To understand that what has happened in our lifetimes has been the deterioration of capitalism in the sense that there is just not enough profit out there for these greedy you-know-whats. And because there is not enough, they are going to make profit by taking it away from us, and we are going to see a period in which our analysis and our strength and our intelligence enlisted on behalf of the little guy who is made to believe by every media outlet, by everything that confronts him in his life or in her life, that is somehow a personal fault. I am losing my house because I am no good and didn't make the payments.
I can't pay off my credit cards because I am unworthy of my credit cards. These credit cards were foisted upon me when I was an undergraduate. And now are looking at me and saying I owe $40,000 and I have to make a payment of $10 each month. Meanwhile, the interest is $500 a month. Something wrong with me for not paying these people back. Or let me buy another lottery ticket and see if I can't get past this. We're human. We're human nature. No one buys more lottery tickets than Mighty Ralph. And he always says, tell me I'm a millionaire. And you know what? I haven't been able to tell him that. Not even a hundredaire, I think. But that is how we are suckered into going along with their programs. And I think for us who have an understanding of what the system is about, which is the fundamental, it is their backs being broken. It is their fundamental unreality to have people who know what they are doing to counter what is happening in Washington and in all the financial capitals of the world. And you can't do that unless you understand the system. And so I think that conferences like this, where we not only talk about this and learn about this and think about this, but also have the opportunity to get from our fellow conferees a sense of, we can do this. We can confront this mammoth, megalith of a country. And in fact, it is the greatest work we can do for the entire international scene, is to confront America, to bring it back to its, not to its sources, because God knows we don't need the sources of America, but to make it into what we would like to see, which is a socialist / communist country, where we can have something to say about that. We need to be, and I'm quoting from some earlier works, in the radical feminist lexicon, we need to be persistent, we need to be patient, we need to expose, we need to raise consciousness levels, we need to eliminate the institutions that are put out there by a patriarchal society, the family, property, popular culture, all of which reinforce stereotypes, all of which make people unable to act on their own behalf. I think the most significant thing in American culture today is that people seem to think they have to act on behalf of millionaire bankers. That people think they have to act on behalf of people who are not at all deserving of their confidence or trust, but that very few people think they have to find a political answer for their own lives. And that is the task before us. Now, how do we get there? How do we do this? Well, you know, lifestyle, I think it was in Clara Frazier's book, she said, quiet as it's kept, living a radical feminist life is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And for that, we need to have this party affiliation that backs us up and a sense of unity. And of course, myself, I've always been from the Action Now school. Actions speak louder than words. Now that's the cliche, but I would alter that to say words hardly speak at all anymore. Actions are what speaks to people. It says something. And even though they want to twist it, even though they want to turn it, even they will do everything, including totally suppress it. How many people here knew that the Vets Against the War took over the National Archives and called for the prosecution of Bush and Cheney last week? Not too many, because they made sure we didn't know about that. And yet this is an action that was planned, that took place, that was successful. And I think about the past. and feminism in particular in the past. You know, Susan Anthony traveled all over this country and spoke, as did Elizabeth Cady Stanton, as did Sojourner Truth, as did Harriet Tubman. But you know, they also acted. Susan B. Anthony went in and voted when she wasn't allowed to, was prosecuted for that, and asked to be sent to jail. But the judge crossed her up and wouldn't do it because he didn't want to make her a martyr. Of course, we know what Harriet Tubman did. Harriet Tubman was not content to talk about the inequalities or what slavery did to people. She went down there and got them out of slavery, brought them out, did it sometimes against their own will, but did it nonetheless. And we can also look at more recent things. Bernadette Devlin McAllister, an Irish patriot who spoke out at the times when the troubles were the worst, who was elected, who suffered, who was shot by the orange men in their own house, and yet continues to this day to speak out to such an extent she was not allowed to enter the country, our country, because she's a terrorist. And also, you know, I have to name, and this is not necessarily the greatest manifestation, but perhaps we ought to talk about Code Pink and the fact that they get out there, that they are, the other day, they had women lying all over the steps of the Capitol saying, no bailout over our dead bodies, which is very graphic and very real. To say it that succinctly, not to do an 8-minute rant or harangue, but just to get out there with your own body and say it. You know, I also am reminded, I was looking through some old feminist writings before I gave the speech. You know, I'm so happy to be asked to speak to radical feminists. To me, this is the highest calling, to overcome all that garbage, race, class, gender, and to rise up and say, no, I understand what the solutions are here, and I'm going to fight for them with everything that I can give it. So I went back to some of the old yellowing pages of the books that we read in the early 70s when we were doing consciousness raising and recognized that we all had similar experience, and even those of us who had been very heavily into the movement realized the necessity to bring our brothers along too, and if they wouldn't come, to cut them loose. That's hard, huh? But anyway, there was a thing in there, a manifesto by a group of women who had gone into a draft board in New York City, destroy all the files in that draft board. They particularly sought out those that said 1A and those that said, they destroyed those files. They put pictures up on the wall of all the people who had died in Vietnam that week, and they sprinkled the place with blood and left. But more than that, 3 days later, they held a press conference and said, we did this. We did this, and we did it because it was the right thing to do. And that is part of doing the righteous action. Sometimes you walk away from it and just let it speak for itself. But other times you claim it. And of course, in claiming it, I'm not happy to say, although I don't think much really happened to them. They not only arrested the women who had actually done it, they arrested everybody at the press conference. You know, they all must have been in on it. We'll take them all away and sort it out later. You know? Typical police reaction, I must say. So my case, which I want to talk about for a little while, because people are always saying, Lynn, you get up there and you talk about the issues, you don't ever tell us what's happening with you. And I talk about it mainly because I think it is an important case in civil liberties. I think it's an important case as to how this government operates and how it makes examples of people so that other people are repressed by that example, and that is what they want to do. You know, it's clear to me that the government really fears women, and I'm not saying all women, but some women. And I'm certainly, I refuse to indulge in the Sarah Palin bashing, because underneath it all, I sense a real sexism. They wouldn't do that if she were a guy. And to me, you know, she's terrible, but she's no terrible than the guys are. She's no terrible than Biden or Obama or McCain. They're all in the same boat. The important thing about my case, I think, is that, you know, people say to me, my best friend, who I've been my best friend since we were in high school together, said, if you don't think this is about the fact that you're a woman, you're crazy. And I think that goes to the sense that the government knows that somehow or other activist women are more to be feared. There's something about our, even the place they give us in society, that we are the somehow or other the keepers of the flame, the keepers of truth, and that we wouldn't risk all this if it weren't for the real cause. So I think the government reached out to me to equate me as a terrorist because I defended terrorists. This was a new stretch for them. And to make sure that lawyers got it, they did it in the context of my representation of Sheikh Omar. We know from Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights, they were training lawyers for Guantanamo the day I was convicted. And then they stopped all the training because the lawyers at this training said, we just want to talk about Lynn Stewart and can what happened to her happen to us? Because that was the lesson that was put out there. The lesson was, you know, don't do more than the government wants you to do. Certainly don't take on the government because you could end up like she did. So in that sense, they have succeeded in a small way. Although this is not to say, and I want to be very clear about this, that there aren't lawyers that are out there fighting every day, that there aren't lawyers who are defending people and doing it at great personal cost and at great personal sacrifice and still carrying on the good fight. But I also do want to say that lawyers, like all people, they're frightened of this government, of the tremendous power that they exert. And I also say that along with printing many, many new dollar bills and new treasury, you're going to see a bigger repression taking place. Because they're not going to tolerate people like us that want to tell the truth about what's going on. And you know they have all the apparatus in place. I'm not here to be a fearmonger, but you have to know if you look at the Minneapolis convention, where not only were the police given free rein by virtue of the Republican Party indemnifying them for any lawsuits that might be brought against them, which means that there was absolutely no backup in terms of they had to be responsible to someone. So I think it's all in place, it's all been kept in place, and I think they are ready to move. And what we have to do is expand and expand and make the movement larger and larger so that we are really too big to be able to be locked up. You know, the old saw was, you can lock up me, but you can't lock up the movement. And I would hope that our movement will be so big and so fearless that they will not be able to do that. My case, I'm sure you all know about, is, you know, I was the lawyer for Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman. I continued being his lawyer after his appeal was lost. The government came into the prison. They listened in on the conversations, which I don't know how many of you folks visit people in prison. If you don't, I would recommend it to everybody. It's a really important and, how can I say it, many of the people who have been in prison for a long time, especially the political prisoners, are people worth knowing. And you leave the jail feeling better about yourself and your struggle than you did when you go in. And that was the way, and people are saying, oh no, you can't say that about an Islamic terrorist, about this or that. Sheikh Omar was a very unusual man, a very smart man. Defense lawyers have a tendency to get very close to their clients. And I did get close to him in the sense that I respected his intellect. We had some real knockdown, drag-out battles politically. We also had some knockdown, drag-out battles about feminism, as you can well imagine. But we respected each other. And I realized at some point in that representation, especially after all had been lost and he was in the middle of Minnesota in the most repressive kind of solitary confinement, visits only from his lawyers, his family couldn't get visas to visit him, he wasn't allowed to have any kind of clergy come in and see him, he wasn't allowed to attend any kind of religious services, he was basically not permitted to talk to the guards, nor them to talk to him. You know, we didn't know it at the time. We're talking now 1997, 8. We didn't know that solitary confinement is perhaps the worst torture of all. You know, to keep somebody incommunicado, and he is blind, of course, besides that. So he is completely cut off on so many levels. And we realize now that it really was having a terrible effect on him mentally. And what to do as his lawyer? What to do? Yes, we could have brought a condition suit. I rather doubt that in Minnesota we would have gotten very far with the arch fiend terrorist in the federal courts. But we could have done that. We had no money to do it. It's always boiling down to that, isn't it? Just like in the movement. There's wonderful ideas out there. We just can't finance them. We just can't do it. But to make a long story short, I did what I could do and what I thought was recognizable and allowable and was my duty as a lawyer. I made a press release for him. Now, the press release did not say, Abdullah, the gold is under the palm tree, or you can pick up 800 AK-47s in Seattle from Val Carson. I mean, it did not say that. It was a political commentary on the moves that his old organization, which was almost defunct at that point, because the repression in Egypt, and if you don't know about repression in Egypt, I suggest everybody check it out. Egypt gets money second only to Israel, and Egypt has some of the most repressive, check out Amnesty, check out Human Rights Watch, and you don't even have to do that. Just know that when they started rendering people, they rendered them to Egypt, where Egypt rendered them from limb to limb to get tortured statements out of them. That is Egypt. So this organization was just about defunct at the time this happened. But notwithstanding that, the press release was purely a political statement about where he thought things should go, how he thought things should be accomplished. And, of course, it caused a big hullabaloo when it was released, but nothing happened. Absolutely nothing happened. And even Ashcroft, at his famous press conference on the case, they said, all right, you made a press release to Reuters, not exactly carrying it out in a hidden spot, and what happened? And even Ashcroft said, well, nothing happened. And nothing did happen. It was a press release, and that's all it was. But 2 years later, and this is the way they operate, needing some fuel to fire up the fear, needing some fuel for their terrorist, quote, juggernaut. And, you know, we've been toying with the notion of saying we're not only against the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the war on drugs, we're also against the war on terrorism because it's a complete farce, basically. At any rate, we made the press release, and as I say, 2 years later, they came after me, and we love to tell this story. You know, we were on our usual rush out the door to get to court, Ralph and I, and I heard him talking to somebody. He was on the front stoop. Now, you know, in New York, a stoop are the front stairs that go up to your front door. They are very useful for those of us who do not go to Southampton for the summer. Because you can sit on your front stoop and watch the neighborhood go by and comment and invite people up and whatever. But anyway, Ralph was out on the front stoop, and I saw, as I came out the door, I saw these people, guys, in our front yard, a little tiny postage stamp of a place, and I knew immediately they were cops. You know, there is something about the polyester and about the shoes in particular. And I hear Ralph saying, I don't see any warrants, I don't see any badges, I don't see anything, I don't know who you guys are. And I came out and I put my hand on his arm and I said, Ralph, take it easy. We'll get you out by lunchtime. He's arrested going to a PTA meeting, and people say to the judge, well, why would you want to go to a PTA meeting? He's been out there all these years. I'm the lawyer. I don't get arrested. I get you out when you get arrested. And they pointed at me and they said, we're not here for him, we're here for you. Well, it's a defining moment. You know, you say, oh my God, what's this about? I know better than to say, what's this all about? Because the next thing, there'll be a statement was made. Client said, what's all this about? Feigning that she didn't know what it was all about. So you don't say anything to them. And that's the first and greatest lesson. Don't talk to cops. Don't talk to FBI, no matter how pleasant, no matter how many times they tell you this is not about you, no matter how many times you're not in trouble. Don't talk to them. So ultimately, I do get out and I've stayed out and I have spoken to a lot of people, though, not to them. And I really do think, and that is part of the radical answer, that is what we have to do. We are transparent. If they come after us, we have got to expose them. We can't be thinking, oh my God, I can hide behind this, I can do that, and maybe I'll get off. You can't do it, because these are politically motivated arrests, and they must be dealt with the same politics that they bring to it. If they're bringing politics to you, you've got to put your politics back on them. So that day when I was arraigned, I tell you, my lawyer that day, who was also one of my oldest friends, said, don't talk to the press, Lynn, because you know they will tear you up. They will, you will. And I said, listen, Tip, I am going to talk to the press, because I know one thing from doing this work and being on some very big cases. The first day, the press will talk to you. The second day, you're old news. So you better get out there and you better hit that 6 o'clock news. They'll put you on. They may not put it all on and they may cut it up in a bad way, but you are just your being out there, just your confronting them is the crucial thing. And that is one of the things that I think this particular speech, the radical dissent, the righteous response, that is the righteous response. So right now, as we approach our 7th anniversary in April of my arrest, and I have been out all this time, have not seen the inside of a jail, and do not intend to see the inside of a jail. The case is on appeal. We argued in January. The court has not yet rendered a decision. Today we had a brief shining moment, and we hope we're trying to capture that glow, because the Second Circuit, which is the case that the court that my case is in front of, decided a case of two Yemenis. And you know, sometimes these cases against the Muslims are so absurd. You wonder how a jury, if they didn't have the worst prejudice paraded before them, that they could ever reach decisions like they reach. I mean, there's a case pending in New York where a guy kept a suitcase in his apartment in London that had in a pair of waterproof socks and a rain poncho, And the government informant is prepared to testify that that was going to go to bin Laden. Materially aiding terrorism. This kid is held in absolute solitary confinement. He's a U.S. citizen. He is a graduate of Brooklyn College. What could be more American than that? And he is being held incommunicado. No contact with the outside world. And the judge is not interested in that. She doesn't want to hear about that. But at any rate, the case that gave us a glow for a moment, and I hope it will transcend, is that these two Yemenis, who they were accused of funneling over $40 million to Hamas and bin Laden, and meanwhile they were selling ice cream on Court Street, you know, just to keep their hand in, I guess, you know. Notwithstanding that, they were convicted. But the court today said that because of the inflammatory nature of the evidence that the government put in and the judge allowed them to put in, they were reversing the case, and in a most unusual step, they were sending it to another judge. So this was very, very important. This judge is, let me not get into this judge, but he's a black man in name only, and he is notorious. He was a special narcotics prosecutor, and he's notorious for his lack of rationality in many things. But at any rate, he allowed in, Israeli witness to a bomb that was allegedly set off by Hamas at a nightclub to testify about the carnage that was caused as he came and found his brother dead and the limbs, etc., that were all there. This was testified to in front of the jury, although it had absolutely nothing. It was introduced for the purpose to show that terrorism is dangerous. They heard this. Now, you're telling me a jury can separate this out? Oh, this is not about this case, even though they're talking about Hamas. This has nothing to do with these guys. And then the second thing was it had to do with a bin Laden training camp where they brought in an expert to talk about. There was one piece of paper that may have had something to do with training in Pakistan. Nothing to do with a bin Laden camp or anything else. They brought in this guy, and he spent days on the stand talking about trainings in explosives, trainings in undercover, everything under the sun, except something to tie into that case. So this three-judge panel decided this was above and beyond. Now, we're happy, I got our glow, because we have alleged the same thing in my trial. In my trial, they brought in many, many times bin Laden, portrayed him in, I think the screen that they had him on was 20 feet by 20 feet. And they also had individual monitors, of course, at each juror's station. And they would talk about how he had chaired a conference about freeing Sheikh Omar. Not that that had anything to do with what we were talking about. We were talking about a press release. And they would play this video, which basically said very little except the Sheikh is being held, he's an innocent man, get him out of jail, etc. But bin Laden in graphic, big time. And the judge actually instructed the jury over 700 times that this evidence has nothing to do with Ms. Stewart, has nothing to do with Mr. Yusri, that was the interpreter. It is not offered, get this, for the truth of the matter asserted there, but it is only offered for the state of mind of the third defendant. Now, you know, you can't say 100 times, don't look at the pink elephant sitting in the corner of the room. The jury is going to glaze over. They're not going to be able to do it in the first place. And so even though that is a difference, apparently this other judge never instructed them anything about the evidence they were hearing. But in our case, we don't think that was enough to cure it. We don't, and so we're hopeful, as I said. The other thing that they put in, of course, was graphic testimony about the Luxor massacre, end quote, which was committed years before the alleged conspiracy I was supposed to be a part of was even alleged by the government, but they brought it in to say, see, this is what these people do. So we're hoping that maybe an appeals court will see that and see the other decision and give us some play here. Although me, I've been a lawyer a long time, I know that on appeal, they're going to hide behind the jury verdict. They're going to hide, especially when it's a high-profile person that they don't want to be bothering with, making trouble for themselves. I also think that given the political nature of our unjust justice system, they're going to wait till after the elections, at least, to see which way the wind blows, although you know, and I know, it's the same wind, and it always blows in the same direction. So, we're agreed that radical feminism is the best way to live. Thank you, Clara Frazier. And of course, and quite as this might be kept, feminism is not a question of gender alone. Just as racism is not necessarily a question of color. It is a question of where people are at with it. And people who can support the notion that women are the bottom rung on the ladder, that black women and women of color are below white women in this ladder of oppression, those are feminists. Those are anti-racists. Those are whatever their color, whatever their gender. So I think that we know that there are different approaches to how we get to where we want to get. I want to suggest some work now. And I, of course, these are my pet hobbies. These are my things that I like to do, but I'm suggesting them to you. First of all, I think working for political prisoners is a crucial thing. And certainly the radical feminists should certainly take on the cases of all the women who are political prisoners. And by that, I'm talking about Marilyn Buck, who is right up here in Pleasanton, who is coming up for... who was named as, and I say this without any fear of disapprobation, I hope, she was named the soul of the Black Liberation Army, a white woman, because she was as strong and as dedicated as any of the men were that were involved in that enterprise. And of course, for that, she has suffered, and she has been in jail for 25 years. She has suffered because she was wounded and injured, and God knows, some people here know better than others, that the medical care in federal prisons is like military music is to music. Not much. So Marilyn Buck, Lori Berenson. Here's a woman who's been in jail in Peru. She's writing letters, and I just have to say, you know, one of the questions I'm always asked is, aren't you afraid to go to jail? And I'm also asked, aren't you just afraid, period? Well, you can't be stupid. You have to know what there is to fear, and you have to understand the nature of what you're up against. But I'm not afraid to go to jail. And Lori, in writing in her latest letter back to us all, she wrote that, and I'm... she said... gotta find it. She said that the thing that sustains political prisoners is knowing they were right. Knowing they were right, that their cause was just, and that they were right. And knowing that there are people out there who know their cause was just, and that they were right. And when it gets to be terrible, to cling to that, to be able to say that, is the most important thing. So let's remember Lori Berenson. She's coming up for parole, but there's a very good chance, even under the new regime in Peru, she won't be paroled, because somehow or other there's exceptions, and the exceptions are always the political people. Also, I'd like to remind Judy Clark, another leftist woman. She's in prison in New York State. She's serving 75 years to life. She was a member of May 19th Communist Organization. I've sat in on many and many, because I represented other people in that case. And this is an expropriation that took place in Nyack, New York. And Judy was always the clearest and the smartest. And she just recently lost a heartbreaking decision where they decided that they were not going to grant her writ of habeas corpus. And you know, President Clinton gave us only one shot at habeas corpus. It used to be, you know, if you had a new and a righteous position, you could go back as many times as there was a claim. No more. So Judy used up her one shot, which was to say that she was denied a fair trial, which she was. And she is now looking at jail for the rest of her life. So you can get people's addresses. If you can't do anything else, one night, pick up your email and then write a letter to some of these folks. You know, you can't call them. You probably have a hard time visiting any of them. But mail is so important to prisoners. Getting a letter from someone they don't know, doesn't matter. Go to the Jericho website. It's got all the names, all the addresses. It's remarkable. And I also would just mention Aide Beltran Torres, the last of the Puerto Rican prisoners who did not accept Bill Clinton's offer of clemency. She has a position politically that you cannot accept favors from your oppressor, and she would not accept the offer. She is still in prison. And also, and probably this is the latest round now, Breanna Waters. Breanna Waters is a, quote, green terrorist. The worst. She was accused of being she was supposed to be a lookout for someone who was setting fire to lumber yards, and was convicted in Seattle of this, and was given a very heavy time, and is, from everybody, from her lawyer, Bob Bloom, who's located in the East Bay area, she is a terrific person. She was convicted once again on the testimony of snitch. This is how they make cases. It's not like they do on TV. They get out there, they get somebody, and they make him tell a story. And I remember when Ralph and I were doing work, and we were talking about how such and such a guy would say such and such a thing, and Ralph would say, well, he couldn't know that. How could he testify about that? I said, don't you understand? It's not what the snitch knows. It's not what the rat knows. It's what the FBI knows. If they know it, they can put it in the person's mouth. And there it comes, out on the witness stand, just like it was there all the time. And we see these cases over and over and over again. We see them particularly in the political cases, because I think they think that as bad as these people are, the people that they're prosecuting, they can make come off worse in front of a jury. I also have been, as was mentioned by Val, I did work on the National Assembly, which is an attempt to bring together in mass action anti-war, to be against. We were able at the conference that was held to broaden it. It was originally troops out of Iraq, and it was added Afghanistan, and now the national conference, you can also find that on the web, is calling for March 21st to be a date of local actions agreed upon by all the organizations. By that I mean ANSWER, United for Peace and Justice, all of these groups that are now against mass action and hopefully looking in the spring to some kind of mass action. We know that's what won when we managed to get them out of Vietnam. That and Ho Chi Minh, of course. But at any rate, so we know that party politics are not the answer, but I just have to say, and I very, very rarely indulged in working in party politics because I really don't believe in them and I don't like them and I think they go nowhere. But I must say that I have worked this year for Cynthia McKinney because I can't find an issue on which I disagree with her. She states, she enunciates exactly what I believe on just about everything. Is she out there? Is she going to tear down the Congress? No. Is she going to do things that maybe you and I would like to do? No. But she stands for something. And she has stood for it for all the years she was in politics. And I think for that reason alone, she deserves our support. I'm not saying it's a sympathy vote, but I don't believe it makes any difference if Obama wins or if McCain wins. And that being said, I say, Cynthia McKinney, if she can get a percentage, we at least may have our feet under the table for any future political conferences. And more than that, for us, she is a vehicle behind which to build a movement. Because she does stand for all the things people we know want to believe in. And even though they're afraid of third parties, but I like third parties. Robert La Follette, Eugene Debs, I love them. They made things happen in this country, the third parties. They were the push. And the Cynthia McKinney, I don't care if you don't like the Greens, and I don't like them myself sometimes, but I like Cynthia, and I like what she stands for. And I have been working as much as I possibly can on her behalf. Now, I've also done some work on a Muslim Innocence Project because people have finally come together and said, you know, these folks are getting a raw deal and we have to do something about it. And so that's something new also. So these are my favorites because there's so much out there, you could go crazy if you try to do everything. And yet, we want to do everything. And when the time is ripe, we do have to support whatever movement is in the street and carrying us on. I mean, people I know spent this whole last week down on Wall Street demonstrating, pouring blood. Because that's where the action is. Because we can give answers that make sense and offer a way to go. Now, coming to this conference today and being in the political position I assume most of us are, we know something about male dominance and patriarchy and the seduction of submission, which is what we see most Americans indulging in. Living under capitalism makes you submissive, makes you say, they know what's best. And that is the surrender of the human spirit, because there is nothing more insidious than people who tell you they know what is best for you. Relax, enjoy it, go along. So with that thought in mind, I want to say that the righteous response to repression in all its forms, whether it's someone you overhear talking some racist nonsense like Obama represents all those black people who couldn't pay their mortgages and they're really what's the cause of this downfall we're facing. To speak up, at the very least, to fight back, to join with other people. I believe that there is a great untapped resource out there, the people. I believe the people comprise immigrants who have never been organized in this country except for some great days when they turned out in force because there was a galvanizing motion, there was a galvanizing issue that pulled them out. We need to organize all those people that never once considered that the answer to their problems is not psychiatric, is not some television guru, but it is political, and that by banding together, you gain strength, you solve your problems, and you know where you're going. I'm going to read a poem, because you know that's my hallmark. I love poetry, and I read poems whenever I speak. And many of you may have heard this, I may have read it before, but it's one of my favorites, and it seems particularly apt at this crossroads. And I think we are really at a point where change is going to come very fast, and we better be ready with some answers for people about why it's happening and what we can do to stop it. This is a poem by Tony Hoagland. It's called Hard Rain. After I heard it's a hard rain's a-gonna fall, played softly by an accordion quartet through the ceiling speakers at the Springdale shopping mall, I understood there's nothing we can't pluck the stinger from. Nothing we can't turn into a soft drink flavor or a t-shirt. Even serenity can become something horrible if you make a commercial about it using smiling white-haired people. Quoting Thoreau to sell retirement homes in the Everglades, where the swamp has been drained and bulldozed into a 19-hole golf course with electrified alligator barriers. You can't keep beating yourself up, Billy, I hear the therapist say on television to the teenage murderer. About all those people you killed, you just have to be the best person you can be. One day at a time. And everybody in the audience claps and weeps a little because the level of deep feeling has been touched. And they want to believe that the power of forgiveness is greater than the power of consequence of history. Dear Abby, my father is a businessman who travels. Each time he returns from one of his trips, his shoes and trousers are covered with blood. But he never forgets to bring me a nice present. Should I say something? Signed, America. I used to think I was not part of this, that I could mind my own business and get along. But that was just another song that had been taught to me since birth, whose words I was humming under my breath as I was walking through the Springdale Mall. Thank you.